Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to the second week of our Bhagavata Vahini fortnight. And we are reaching towards the end of the mammoth work, this epochal work of Bhagwan, the Bhagavata Vahini. Who better than Swami to tell us the story of the Krishna avatar and the other avatars? Almost feels like an autobiography, for it is indeed an autobiography. And both Prem and myself, we have been blessed, we have been privileged. It has been our pleasure to actually go through the second autobiography, the first one having been the Ramkatha Rasavahini, which is another beautiful work. So, with gratitude in our heart, with lots of love, we offer ourselves at Bhagwan's lotus feet and proceed with where we had possibly left off last week. It's very interesting that in Krishna's life also, the way Swami has dealt with, he has not gone in a chronological order. He has gone in a kind of a thematic manner. And it is very wonderful and apt over here, because this theme is based on what King Parikshit is going through. King Parikshit has been cursed that in another week's time, his life is going to come to an end. And like it happens with all of us, when death is staring at us in our face, our priorities in life get realigned. That's what happens in Parikshit's life also. And it is credit to him that he gives complete importance to the top priority, which is moksha, salvation. And that is why he renounces his kingdom, gives up everything, detaches himself completely from everything else in order to attach himself to Bhagwan and the leelas of Bhagwan. That is how he is listening to the story of Krishna. And Shuka Maharshi, the great sage who is expounding this Bhagavatam to him, he also is telling the stories in such an order so that as he goes closer to death, he also goes closer to immortality. That is why we see that a kind of chronology is not maintained. And in the beginning, while we have already discussed many incidents from the life of Bhagwan Krishna with the Pandavas and during the Kurukshetra war, later on we have come to how he killed the Rakshasas. Now, last week we went into how he got his education done, and as we shall see in the next fortnight, which possibly might be the concluding fortnight, we will be going actually into the birth of Krishna. That is how it is placed in the Bhagavata Vahini. And so, offering ourselves once again at Bhagwan's lotus feet, after this lengthy introduction, I welcome Brother Prem. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and as you put it, it's not in chronological order, but it's in a very beautiful and interesting thematic order. And as the story is progressing, we know that Parikshit is coming to the end of those 7 days. And understandably, his focus is on some topics which are very pertinent to the situation that he is going through. Because at this point, there is a short discussion between Shuka Maharshi and Parikshit on what Maya is all about. Because as we spoke about, the previous one was the story of Krishna and Balarama in the ashram of Sandipani, where the idea of the all-knowing one being a student in the hermitage of a teacher who probably does not have a mention elsewhere. You know, when he spoke about Ramayana, Vasishta and Valmiki are big names even for the times of Ramayana. But if you look at the Krishna avatar, I think Sage Sandipani gets his prominence because of his association with Lord Krishna, because of being the teacher of Krishna. So there, that idea that here is this all-knowing Lord was incarnated in a human form, and he is under the tutelage of a pious Brahmin, a pious sage. Right, so that is when he asked this, you know, why does Lord play this Maya? Why does he play this role? And in fact, the conclusion of that episode is Krishna bringing back to life the dead son of Sandipani. So all the more making it clear that here is the all-powerful one who can beckon the Lord of Death and say, give back the son that you've taken away. And he obliges even without an argument. You know, that's how Swami writes it. Immediately, Yama calls for his minions and he says, get the boy back and give it in the care of Lord Krishna. So it is so obvious that this is the Supreme Lord and he chooses to play that role, and that is where the discussion starts, where Parikshit says, you know, this is clearly the play of Maya. And why does the Lord play the Maya like this, and why do people get trapped in it even in spite of seeing his glory? And that is when Sukamarshi explains the role of merit and sin when it comes to being entangled in Maya.
In this context, Prem, though it is not described in the Bhagavata Vahini, I think we had made a reference to it last week about an incident concerning Sudama, one of Krishna's classmates. And it becomes very relevant here when you bring up the theme of Punya and Papa, merit and sin, the effect of past deeds. Because Shuka Maharshi says that what the Maya that covers you, that Maya is influenced actually by your own deeds in the past. So, good or bad, that is how the Maya comes and envelops, and therefore it is important to examine the past. And when we look at the life of Sudama as well, you know, it's very, very beautiful, the story. The story goes that Sudama is from a very poor background. He's a poor Brahmin, and that poverty continues across generations, and therefore Sudama is also very poor, hardly having any food at home to feed his children. But he has great love for Krishna. And this great love for Krishna is what sustains him, keeps him going. He performs his daily actions in his love for Krishna. His wife keeps prodding him, why don't you go to Krishna and ask him for help? Because Krishna is now the emperor at Mathura Nagari. He is the king. You can ask him. But Sudama says no. Because, you know, he believes in true friendship, which goes beyond material gifts. It often makes us nostalgic about Swami's own childhood, right? I think we had recounted how somebody tried to gift a uniform to Swami.
Right. I think the two classmates of Swami, the boy who was the son of the
police.
Right. It was just before the Kamalapuram cattle fair when Sirastidar's son, which is I think Ramesh or the other boy, who sees that Swami is backing out of that cattle fair as a NCC cadet because Swami is not able to afford the uniform which has to be worn mandatorily. And that's why he pretends to his father that he likes this khaki dress so much that he wants another pair stitched. And he is trying to give that pair to Swami. And he knows that Swami is not a person who will accept such gifts. So he does not dare to give it to Swami directly. He puts it in a cover and he writes a covering letter saying that, Swami says that he writes, Raju, if you consider me as your friend, if you consider me as your brother, you should take this from me. And if you don't take it, then I'll end my life. I think that's what he writes, and he puts it under Swami's desk. And Swami says that he sees the thing, he tears up that letter, and Swami writes another letter. And Swami says that there should not be any give and take between true friends. And if you wish this friendship...
Give and take in the material sense.
In the material sense. And Swami says, if you wish that this friendship should continue, if that is what you want, then you should not force me to take this. And, you know, beautifully, because here is this boy threatening Swami with his death, but Swami is threatening him with something which is beyond death. He says, if you want this friendship to last, and he knows when Swami says last, it means beyond birth and death. And that,
I don't know if that little boy realized it.
Right, but that was something which is more tough for him to accept than death itself. And that's why he accepts Swami's, you know, refusal to accept that uniform.
And that kind of friendship is ingrained in Sudama, and therefore he's refusing. Till it comes to a point wherein there is a very tyrannical local chieftain or somebody, you know, a feudal lord, whose way Sudama happens to get into, and he commands Sudama. You know, because Sudama doesn't have any wealth that he can take away in punishment. He commands him that you sing my glory or else you'll be thrashed or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Sudama refuses to give up Krishna's name, and Sudama gets beaten. Sudama is humiliated. That is when his wife says, if not for your sake, at least for the sake of our children, for my children's sake, go to your friend and ask him for help. And Sudama agrees for that. The next day when he has to set out to Mathura, his wife actually makes a little food to be taken to Krishna and offered, because it is said that when you visit your friend's home, always you take something for the friend, and the friend who is playing host also gives you something. It happens like that. It's a kind of a give and take out of love. So she makes some food and gives, and Swami would call it as atukulu or beaten rice. And in Hindi it's called poha. He hides this beaten rice. She puts it in one small cloth bag and he hangs that bag by his waist. He goes there. And, you know, there are many beautiful poems and there are many wonderful songs which depict the happenings at the palace of Lord Krishna, where Sudama comes there and he tells the guards over there, I would like to meet Krishna. And the guards say, yes, yes, everybody likes to meet Krishna. He says, no, I am not anybody. I am, tell Krishna that his dear friend has come. And they laugh. They laugh at him and they say, you dear friend of you, which Krishna are you talking about? Do you know Krishna, the Dwarka, the Lord of Mathura? He's a king and how can you be a friend? But on Sudama's insistence, finally the soldiers walk up to Krishna, the all-knowing one. Not that he doesn't know, but this is what Maya is, where the Lord plays out his role. Maya is playing out the role, though you know that you're just an actor and you're put on the dress. So when Krishna is told that Sudama has come, he runs all the way from his royal throne to the gates to welcome Sudama. Everybody is shocked. They're surprised. The guards are wondering, what is this happening? You know, they're all, as Krishna runs across the yard, runs across the palace, everybody's falling on their feet because, falling to their knees, I mean, because the king is coming. And out of respect, they're falling on their knees, but he seems to be in a tearing hurry. Different poets, different songs have described it in different manner, but all of them say that the way he rushed, you know, Krishna's upper body cloth falls off, his slippers come off, but Krishna doesn't seem to be, he seemed to be so excited. He rushes and embraces Sudama at the gate. And this is a sight for everyone to see, this king, this imperial one, decked in all, bedecked in all finery, in all regal clothes, the crown, everything. But and here is this poor Brahmin, soiled clothes, tattered clothes, and, you know, grimy, dusty. But Krishna embraces him, hugs him, takes him to the palace, makes him sit on the throne. And everybody is shocked. Krishna sits at his feet and starts washing his feet and tells him, I'm so happy to see you. This is what happens. You know, when this happens, it is said that Krishna's wife, Rukmini, she also, the queen, she also seeing this. And Krishna asks Sudama, what have you brought for me? Have you got something for me? And Sudama is actually very hesitant. He's trying to say, nothing, O Lord. Nothing, Krishna. And he's hiding the pouch because he's ashamed. He's feeling, how can I offer? What is this I have brought? Krishna eats the greatest of delicacies in golden plates. From this dirty, soiled cloth, eating this beaten rice. It's a poor man's food. But the moment Krishna sees that, he says, Sudama, this is my favorite. He takes, and Swami would say, ah, atukulu. And, you know, he picks it up with a fistful of it and puts it in his mouth. And Swami would narrate how Rukmini comes and says, oh Lord, give me, I also want to have the rest. You know, because what is so amazing on this food? Possibly because Krishna is Yogishwara. He's not a yogi, he's a Yogishwara. He's a Lord of the yogis. He's not attached to anything at all. So possibly dinner also, dinner, lunch or breakfast, anything for Krishna must have just been a kind of, you know, formality to be done. Something that is done in order to maintain the body. But with this kind of eagerness, excitement and, you know, thrill, Krishna is partaking something. So Rukmini says, I also want to eat. What is it? What is so tasty in that? She realizes that it is the love and devotion of Sudama that Krishna is enjoying. That is what the Lord eats. You know, Swami would say, your bliss is my food. That is what it is. Our love, our bliss, our joy, that is what is the Lord's food. And it is said that the moment Krishna puts that in his mouth, there's an instant transformation. Sudama's house becomes a palace there. Sudama becomes one of the richest people there. Because Sudama, though he stays a day or two with Krishna there, enjoying the royal hospitality, for once although he never tells Lord, give me some money, I came actually for that. He feels no need. He's just lost in the love of the Lord. And that's what happens when you truly experience God's love. This is what happened to Vivekananda when he came in front of the mother to ask for riches, to ask for power, to ask for that, whatever he needed. He just was dumbstruck because when you are truly in the presence of the divine, all your desires automatically vanish. like how the clouds part before the sun. That's how it all vanishes and you seek nothing but the Lord Himself. And that's what Sudama truly sought. But finally what he got was everything. Like Swami says, the Lord is the fruit, the world is its shadow. When you get the fruit, the shadow of the fruit also automatically comes. Instead, if you try to take only the shadow, you will not get the shadow, nor will you get the fruit. So that is what happened to Sudama. But, so lost in the story that I went into all details. The reason why the story came up is because, why did Sudama have to suffer that poverty is actually because of an episode that happened in the Gurukula days.
Right. I think the dish in contention there was the same, this Atukulu only, which was there, which was the center of that episode there. Because as part of the duties they would perform in the Gurukula, the children were asked to go out and bring firewood for the ashram. And whenever they are sent on errands like this, the Guru Mata or the wife of the Guru would Sandeepani's wife would pack food for all of these children.
So some cases they say Atukulu, some cases they say grams.
But some grams, I think.
Yes.
Which is something which is like a dry substance which can be carried and it's not a wet kind of a food. So I think something like that she packs for these children so that they can take. And if at all they get stuck or if it gets late, they can munch something and not feel hungry. So when they go out for this, bringing these firewood, I think they get caught in a downpour. And that's when they all get stuck till very late in the evening. And they end up climbing three different trees. That is Balrama, Krishna and Sudama. And the food item which the mother sends for them is stuck up with Sudama. So he is stuck up in, I think, the highest branch, and Krishna and Balrama are in the lower branches. And
Krishna is hungry.
Right, Krishna is hungry, and they're wondering what happened to that food that the mother gave.
And all three are actually hungry. And Krishna, in fact, tells Sudama, I'm hungry. Have you anything that I can eat? At that point, Sudama is so hungry. And at the same time, he also feels that, what this, again, it's the same soiled kind of thing, because throughout the day it's been with him, it's got wet in the rain, and it's, so he feels it is not worthy of being offered to Krishna also. So both the things he feels, one he feels is, I'm not going to give this to Krishna because, one, I'm so hungry, I can eat of the whole thing. Plus, this is not worthy of Krishna. So with these two thoughts, Sudama has partaken that. All said and done, whatever be the thing, your actions are bound to have reactions. So, in the same kind of feeling, here is Sudama in need of, not just food, in need of everything. That is how poor he is. A similar situation has been created where he is equally poor and he is also in possession of something which he feels is too low to be offered to Krishna. And this time he does the right thing because he offers it to Krishna. In fact, Krishna, that is the Lord's love for the devotee. Krishna is so eager to ensure that the devotee does the right thing because he knows that this is coming back as a karmic consequence. So even before Sudama can take a decision when he is hesitating, Krishna himself snatches that bag and says, no, I am going to eat it. And once the Lord's hunger is satiated, everything is satiated. I mean, we have seen this happening again and again. We had discussed about how Durvasa and his entire retinue of sages' stomachs were filled with the Lord being satisfied with one small leaf that Draupadi offers. So that is what happens in the case of Sudama also. And this brings us back to our discussion on this Maya and how all of this is intertwined to past deeds. One cannot escape one's karma. In fact, as we shall see, even the Lord himself, when he takes a human form, he behaves in accordance to the laws of karma that he himself has set up.
Right. And this one episode of Sudama and Krishna, I think one thing which Swami would often say is, especially when divinity incarnates in a human form, and Swami would say this about himself too, Swami would make this statement that I'm selfless from top to toe. There is no trace of impurity in me. There has not been a single impure thought which has crossed my mind. That is the nature of an avatar. And the Lord incarnates in a human form. That's how it is. And Swami would say it is so very dangerous to do something which is a betrayal of such a pure being. And in fact, that is one of the reasons why Swami would be so particular that I think we made a mention of this before. There was one interview for some youth whom Swami had told that I'll call you in the morning, and I think Swami was busy and Swami had to call them the next day. So by then they had given went to all the emotions, and they were very angry with Swami, and they said, Swami, you give word but you don't keep it like this, and all kinds of within themselves in their room or in their shed they were talking all these things. But Swami called them the next day, and Swami made this statement while talking to them. Swami said, you know, boys, make a promise to me that at no condition that you will speak ill about Swami. You know, you should never do that. And they knew that this was Swami was saying this because they were doing that very thing the previous day. But then the way Swami said it was very, very profound. Swami said, see, it's not that I mind. I have no problem at all with it. You know, it doesn't touch me anyway. But it is bad for you. You are doing something which is going to harm you. Because talking ill or trying to do something which is harmful towards a person who is so pure is actually the worst sin that you could perform. Right? You know, harming anybody is itself wrong, and harming anybody out of selfishness is wrong, but harming somebody who is anyway not selfish in any way, and you know, he's all the time trying to think of your benefit, trying to do something which is right for you, and to talk ill of that person or trying to do something which is ill against that person is probably the worst way you could do something which will come back to you in a big, big way. And that's one thing which Swami would often remind us of. And in fact, that is a concept which is there in Tamil. They would say that especially property which belongs to a temple, property which belongs to an ashram, you better not lay your hands on that. Don't covet it, because it's very, very sinful in that sense.
I'm reminded of a similar kind of incident which Bhagya sir had narrated. I think we should contact him again for more details. Mm-hmm. But the central part of that is, in an interview or in a one-to-one conversation sometime, he asked Swami, whatever you wish, whatever you desire, why don't you come and directly tell us to do it? Because, you know, it becomes so easy. You will hint at it, you will tell in a discourse, we are supposed to decipher it. And instead of that, why don't you come directly and tell Bhagya, do this, you do that. It would be so easy. Swami said, it is not difficult for me to come and tell directly, but so many things that I wish to tell you directly, do you have the capacity and the strength to follow it? And that is what Swami asked. He said, then Swami said, if I give you a direct command and you disobey it, the sin that is amounted from that, the negative that you generate because of that is tremendous. And I love you so much that I can't subject you to that. That is why, you know, I tell indirectly, or I leave hints, or I do it through a discourse which is not direct to you. I do in all these indirect ways, because when you disobey and when you don't follow that, it becomes more forgiving for you, because it can be said that no, it was not told directly to him, so maybe he didn't understand, maybe he was innocent. But the sin of disobedience of a direct command is tremendous and terrible. And that is the reason, only when I have complete confidence that somebody has the capacity, the willingness, the inclination and the strength to do it, do I come and give a direct command. I mean, it is so beautiful when we look at all these, because though the Lord always plays by the rules, though the Lord, you know, He himself plays by the rules when He takes a avataric, when He takes a human form, He is always trying to see what He can do within the rules itself, so that all of us progress. That is the love of Swami that we have been lucky to experience and continue to experience.
Absolutely. I think we'll take a short break here before we continue to the story. Of course, that was a flashback back to Sandeepani Ashram. But now we will go back into this question that Parikshit is asking about Papa and Punya, and the answer which the sage gives, more in context with redemption of some of the sins that one commits, because as we said, that is so pertinent to Parikshit at this moment. But we'll do that after this short break.
Murali Dhara Mukunda Murari. Murali Dhara Mukunda Murari. Govardhana ಗಿರಿಧಾರಿ ಮುರಾರಿ ಗೋವರ್ಧನ ಗಿರಿಧಾರಿ ಮುರಾರಿ ನಾಟಕ ಸೂತ್ರಧಾರಿ ಮಾಯಾ ನಾಟಕ ಸೂತ್ರಧಾರಿ ಮಾಯಾ ನಾಟಕ ಸೂತ್ರಧಾರಿ ಮಾನುಷ ವೇಷಧಾರಿ ಮಾಯಾ ಮಾನುಷ ವೇಷಧಾರಿ ಮುರಳೀಧರ ಮುಕುಂದ ಮುರಾರಿ ಗೋವರ್ಧನ ಗಿರಿಧಾರಿ ಮುರಾರಿ ಮಾಯಾ ನಾಟಕ ಸೂತ್ರಧಾರಿ ಮಾಯಾ ನಾಟಕ ಸೂತ್ರಧಾರಿ ಮಾಯಾ ಮಾನುಷ ವೇಷಧಾರಿ ಸಾಯಿ ಮುರಾರಿ ಸತ್ಯ ಸಾಯಿ ಮುರಾರಿ ಸಾಯಿ ಮುರಾರಿ ಸತ್ಯ ಸಾಯಿ ಮುರಾರಿ ಮುರಳೀಧರ ಮುಕುಂದ ಮುರಾರಿ.
Welcome back, dear listeners. As we just said before we took that short break, the question that Parikshit is posing before Seth Sukha right now is the role of Papa and Punya, because that is what Seth Sukha says makes one get trapped in Maya and makes one go beyond it too. When one does enough merits, and he says it doesn't happen in a moment, it does not happen in one's immediate lifetime sometimes, but it is the accumulated merit of so many births that when you are face to face with divinity, you recognize it, or when you have the opportunity, you go beyond what covers. I think that short part of the Maya we'll come to eventually, because that is also very important, and it's quite obvious, like, you know, how we saw in many places in the Ramakatha Rasavahini, Swami takes the opportunity to go into details of some of these things because it is very relevant for us. And when you read it, you know that there is a message which Swami is giving for Swami's devotees as such when we read through that. But talking about this Papa and Punya, the Parikshit asks that, so Krishna also must have come apart from to fulfill the desires of the devotees for redemption of some of those who are stuck in lower forms. Isn't that true? And are there stories from the life of Lord Krishna which pertains to this kind of grace? And that is where, you know, Sukha laughs and he says, in fact, every asura who was killed was a form of redemption. And I think we had mentioned a few of them even when we were doing. Most of these asuras were stuck up in the form of an animal or an asura or something like that, and Krishna redeemed them. And that is the case with everybody. I think even in Ramayana we had many episodes like that, where, including the episode of Ahalya, where many of the redemptions were performed by the avatar.
You know, it's very interesting your choice of word when you say they were stuck in that form, stuck in a lower form, or because that is what Maya is precisely about. When we say that he's stuck in an animal form, when I am stuck in a human form, it is stuck because, like we had discussed last week, during a drama or a movie, if the person forgets that he's an actor playing a role and he confuses himself or herself to be the role itself, then he or she gets subjected to the joys and sufferings of that role as a mother, as a father, as a king, as a beggar, whatever it is. But if the actor or actor is able to keep in her or his mind that I am just an actor playing this role, I am not this role, then whatever the joys and sorrows of the role do not touch the actor. So when we say that a person is stuck in a form, it is like saying that a person is stuck in that role. That person forgets that he is the actor or she is the actor and gets stuck in that role. For instance, there might be a man actually doing a girl's role. We have had that so many times in convocation dramas. In fact, I remember as an aside one little drama where he's a senior, a 2 year senior to me. He was supposed to act the role of Mahalakshmi, the wife of Lord Vishnu. And this was a shadow play. In the shadow play, in the sense that person is not going to be seen at all, just the silhouette of the person will be seen. But Swami went to great extent in decking up this boy, you know, with the crown, with the jewel, the sari, including makeup. You know, it didn't make sense to us at all. You know, why makeup to a person, an actor who will be just seen as the role, not as the role, as a shadow? But that is how Bhagwan does things. It must be that boy's karma.
Talking about Maya and acting, I'm reminded of an incident which I think Mr. Indreshwar had shared.
Mm-hmm.
This happened when he was a student in Vrindavan, and they had staged a drama. They were preparing for a drama in the auditorium for the students.
Mm.
And that was the time apparently Swami just came to Vrindavan, and Swami, in a conversation in the evening in Thrive Vrindavan, I think asked, is there anything, any program or anything like that? And one of the boys was sitting in front, he said, Swami, we're preparing a drama. And all the others who were involved with that were like, oh God, why is he telling about that drama? It's definitely not of a standard, you know, suitable to be staged in front of Swami.
Hmm.
But Swami's eyes lit up and said, oh, there's a drama. When are you putting it up? I'll come and see. So before they could realize, the date was fixed and it was going to be staged in the auditorium and Swami was going to come and see. So they had to, you know, it was supposed to be like the typical dramas which we have. We don't think too much about the props and, you know, costumes and all that. But because Swami was coming, everything had to be lifted up a little bit. But Swami came, and needless to say, I mean, that was quite a disaster of a drama, even for the hostel standards. Right? And all the other boys were like, oh God, is this got to be staged in front of Swami and all that? But for some reason, Swami liked it so much. And Swami said, this drama is so nice, it has to be staged in the Purnachandra Auditorium in front of all devotees. Okay? And they had no clue what is happening. But Swami said it, so that's what it is. But then Swami said, I'm going to Parthi now. I'll send word and you can all come and stage it in the Purnachandra Auditorium. And promptly like that, Swami went back, and I think within a week or something, they got a message from Parthi saying that Swami is asking all those boys who staged the drama to come to Parthi. Right? And it was during the exam time. The exams were going on and they said, Swami wants you to come over for the weekend. Right? So they literally wrote the exam a little earlier by a few hours and they left by a special bus to come to Parthi. And they were all very hesitant about this drama because it was not so good. Right? And in the drama, there was one boy who was playing the character of the wife of the character that Indreshwar was playing. Right? And he was very hesitant, you know, because it was a drama in front of the students, he signed up to act as a lady. But now it's in front of this huge audience in the Purnachandra Auditorium, so he was very embarrassed about it. And Swami noticed that, you know, so he was very hesitant. And Swami said, don't worry, you'll do well, you know, Swami is there, Swami will take care and all that. And the drama was purely a pretext because they all went to Parthi, and morning and evening, Swami is calling them for interviews, talking about everything other than the drama. Maybe for 2 minutes about the drama. So finally that evening when the drama was supposed to be staged, Swami came backstage and Swami was checking all their costumes and all. And Swami came and saw this boy who was dressed up in a sari. And Swami said, hey, who tied the sari for you? It's so horrible. You're not looking like a girl at all. And Swami said, I will dress you up. Okay. And Swami spent about 10 minutes dressing this boy up. And the students who were involved in the drama were saying that they just were outside when Swami was getting this boy ready. When Swami left, they couldn't believe what Swami left behind. He was really looking like a girl. know, Swami had done such a good job of that makeup and dressing of this boy. And this boy also was like so comfortable being in that, you know, girl's costume after that. So they were all very happy. Everything went on well. But everything really did not go on well because there were a lot of bloopers during the drama and they felt that they had let down Swami and all that. So all the boys were dejected. They all went away. So when Indreshwar went backstage, only this boy who was dressed up as a lady was there. And he had not changed. So this Indreshwar thought that maybe he's so low that the drama tanked so badly that he's depressed. So he went and consoled him and said, "Hey, don't feel so bad, man. We'll, you know, it's okay. We tried our best. Change and let's go." And this boy, he turns to Indreshwar and says, "How can I change? There's so many boys here." He said, "So what? Change and come." He said, "No, how can I change? I mean, I need a separate room. I can't change in front of all the other boys and men here." And he was saying that it didn't strike him, but suddenly it occurred to him that in those 10-15 minutes that Swami had spent dressing up this boy, something Swami had done that this boy was literally convinced that he was a girl. And he was saying it was not ordinary. This boy was really speaking as though he was a woman and he could not, you know, do some things which the other boys were doing. Mm-hmm. And he said Swami had probably just to show that his ability to, you know, put you in that maya or what it is, he felt that the whole drama was played only for that one experience to be given to that boy and those around. And that boy was not hesitant to convey this to Indreshwar because in the drama he acted as the husband.
Hmm.
Right, so eventually the boys had to clear out everybody and this boy had to change. And once he had changed, then he was back to his normal self.
Wow.
So talking about acting a role and maya being put on you and you being so convinced about it, I was reminded of this, you know,
That's some real fantastic and, you know, almost bordering on bizarre kind of experience because we have Swami trying to remove us from the maya of the real world. This is a real world in the sense, again, there it's paradoxical when I say that. But yeah, what we consider the real world and that is the dramatic world. So he's removing us from the maya of the real world. Here we have Swami putting on the maya even in the dramatic world. It's phenomenal. And yeah, so it comes to that. That is what happened to that boy is getting stuck in the role. Actually, if you see.
Right.
And that is why we say that these people are stuck in lower bodies. These people are stuck. All of us are actually stuck in that sense. And only we can be awakened. And that awakening comes in different ways. For some, it is through life. For some, it is through death. For some, it is through an accident. For some, it is through a tragedy. For some, it is through a celebration. For some, it is through a victory. If you look at King Ashoka, right? The Kalinga War.
Right.
Yes. So, for him, this awakening came through a massive victory. He won the greatest war of his times and after that decided that everything is useless. For some, this thing comes in time of absolute tragedy. You know? For Alexander the Great, the king, that's what happened, the emperor. He, at the time of his death, that is when he realized everything is useless. So this awakening can come through different times, this awakening from the maya. And that is why when it comes to God, whether God blesses you or cuts you down to size or chops you down to pieces, whatever he does is for our good because all of that is to take us further away from maya into our own reality. That is why it is said that every rakshasa that Krishna killed, they got redeemed because they were stuck. And Krishna redeemed them. And it is very interesting and natural also that King Parikshit is very eager to know about this because right now he's at possibly the penultimate stage now. He's also stuck and he's seeking liberation. He wants to be free and be one with the Lord. And therefore he says, "Oh Shuka Maharshi, I am very, very interested in knowing this. You know, though you have narrated all the stories of different demons and rakshasas being killed, the focus was on the Leela that Krishna did, not so much on how those beings were completely redeemed. So with the focus on redemption, can you narrate to me any incident of a curse and a cure?" That is the question that Parikshit asks.
Right. And the interesting thing about, this is probably the most interesting thing about Indian mythology and all of our epics, that there is always a story which is behind what meets your eye. So on one hand, you're constantly told to discriminate between right and wrong and constantly told that choose to do what is right. But even a person who seems to be so evil and wicked, you're always told that there is a story behind him. And, you know, probably when you go behind a couple of lives and a couple of events which led him to that particular position that he is in, you would see that he was probably a noble person. So on one hand, you're told to discriminate when you're performing an action, when you're making a choice, but you're also always given a reason to not judge the person in front of you. And that is the beauty of all these stories, because all of these asuras, at some point in the dramatization of all these episodes, will always have that, finally that being from that asura's body raises and salutes Krishna and goes away. And you would have all of these yakshas, and all of them will be cursed. They would have made somebody upset, and they would be born here. So all of these stories, I think that is the lesson. And if you look at anybody, I think each one of us will have enough number of people whom we'll come across, whom we might judge as unpleasant and bad and cruel or whatever it is. I think this is the lesson the epic is trying to teach, that you choose right and wrong. You have to do that. Discrimination is something which you cannot run away from. That is what is actually going to take you to doing punya and eventually take you beyond maya. But at the same time, as much as possible, try to avoid judging the person in front of you, because you never know the story which has led to that person being what he is.
And that is very, very, very challenging, because when they say do not judge the person in front of you because you don't know his or her past, here the past refers even to previous births. Because if I forget that aspect, that it might also record previous births, I may feel that it's okay to judge my parents, my wife, my kid, possibly my friends, whom I know from 20 years. I know their past, and therefore I know everything about them, and therefore it's fine if I judge. There also I will be going wrong, because I know only their near term past, possibly. The past 20 years I know, past 40 years I know, past 80 years I know, that's all. What is 80 years? It's a blip in the time scale of the Lord, in the time scale of multiple births that we take. And therefore, it becomes important to keep in mind that these are things that might also have got to do with multiple births. And therefore, we really don't have enough info, enough knowledge, enough insight about anybody that we meet in life. The analogy that comes to mind is how our close relations, our friends in life, have been referred to as floating pieces of wood in a river. You know, the river has a long journey from the source till the ocean. And along the journey, if there's a piece of driftwood, for some time some other piece of wood drifts close by, and there are two driftwoods float together for some time. That is possibly one lifetime. To think that you know each other so well, you know everything about each one's history, what, where you have come from, is so wrong, because after a short distance, one piece of wood might get stuck somewhere in the river or drift somewhere else, the other drifts off somewhere else. Therefore, we have to keep this in mind, and as you rightly said, not judge anybody. At the same time, keep judging our own selves, so that we discriminate and keep on the path of the good. These are the two lessons that come out so clearly. And in order to highlight that, Shuka narrates the incident of how Krishna actually fells two trees, two big Arjuna trees. And this story has got a history. It is actually a story of a curse and a cure. And Parikshit, when he gets to know of it, he's also very eager. He says, yes, I have heard of this. I would like to listen to it in great detail. Please narrate it. And that's why Shuka goes ahead with narrating this beautiful episode.
And Swami, in the course of narrating this episode, actually gives a beautiful description of the whole scenario and the whole setup of the Gokul Vrindavan, where Krishna is residing, the kind of ambience in which he is growing up, the kind of a person that Mother Yashoda is. In fact, there's even a physical description of Mother Yashoda in the course of that particular episode that Swami is writing, which probably you don't think of when you're thinking of Mother Yashoda sometimes. So there Swami writes that, you know, she is actually the wife of the chieftain of the village. But even then, Swami says that she is the one who does all the important household works, especially all those that relates to the milk and the milk products that are produced in the house, which is the milking of the cows, then the churning of the butter to you know, of the buttermilk to get the butter and the making of the ghee. And all of this, and Swami says how she wakes up very, very early in the morning to, you know, catch up with all of these works. And as it happens in all families, the children are made to sleep as long as they, you know, they possibly can, so that the mothers can finish as much work as they can before the children wake up, and, you know, then they become the center of activity for the mothers. And that's typically the same scenario in the household of Lord Krishna too. So on one day, as Sukamashi is saying, that she's churning the butter when Krishna wakes up earlier than he's supposed to, or he usually does, and becomes very hungry. It's about 4 in the morning before the sun is actually risen, and he comes to the Mother Yashoda, and basically he's hungry, so he's crying for attention.
And when he cries for attention, Mother Yashoda sees this little child and she's surprised, and she's like, Krishna, you woke up so early? Possibly Krishna is so tiny, he's a toddler, he can hardly speak and respond, but mothers have this way of carrying out conversations even with days old baby, even with babies which are still in their womb, you know. So mothers don't need a response from the child as such to carry out the conversation. So Yashoda continues to tell, oh my baby, you woke up so soon, what is this, come here. And she fondles him, embraces him, and when Krishna cries, that says that he is hungry, she stops what she's doing and she puts him to her bosom and starts feeding him. In that process, when as she's feeding him, Krishna is very contented. He stops crying. He's very peaceful. He's very happy. At that point in time, there is a kind of noise that she hears, and she thinks that there's a cat that has come to possibly drink away the curd or milk which has been kept in some pot.
Right.
So in order to check upon that, she puts the baby down, puts baby Krishna down, and goes to see what has happened. This infuriates that little Krishna, that, you know, his feeding has been interrupted and Yashoda mother has gone away. And so he starts kicking out his leg and hands very furiously. In the process, he kicks the pot of fresh butter that has been made, and the pot in which she is, you know, actually churning this butter. So everything gets broken and spilt, the curd, butter, everything is spilt. And in that confusion and that mess, Krishna actually crawls away and runs away from that spot, crying, or I don't know, I mean, in a kind of agitation, he goes away. And Swami describes further what happens, but, you know, as I was reading this prem, it struck me that, like everything in Bhagavata Vahini, this too is very metaphorical. Possibly we have not been able to see the metaphorical angle for everything that Bhagavan writes, but everything Swami writes is with a purpose. When I was reading this part, what I felt is, it is symbolic of the Brahma Muhurtam being auspicious, because that is the time God comes to us. Swami has so many times emphasized on doing spiritual tasks, doing sadhana during the Brahma Muhurtam, which begins at 4 a.m. 4 a.m. to 8 a.m.
Right.
And it's not coincidence that when Swami says at that time God comes to you, here literally God comes to Yashoda. And Yashoda rightfully decides to give her time and attention to the Lord. That's what God expects us to do, that when He comes to us, we offer our time, energy and attention to Him. But as it happens, you know, our attention gets diverted. It happens, you know, on the few occasions when I try to actually do this. Early in the morning, you try to do sadhana, your mind starts going off to already the day ahead, you know. This task has to be done, that has to be done. I have to get breakfast, maybe I have to do this, or maybe I have to go to the bank, I have to deposit this money, I have to do that. So many things start crowding at that point in time. I think the cat, that is the cat that, you know, breaks the pot or makes Yashoda feel that a pot might be broken. Because of which we let go of God and start pursuing those thoughts. That's what angers God. Because anger is again not as a personal anger. It is because we are going away from doing the right thing. And that is when, you know, it is like, what do you think? You think money is more important than me? You think relationship is more important than me? You think your work is more important than me? You thought that the cat broke that pot of milk, right? Here I will break that pot of milk myself. To show you that you think this is more important. And that is when, you know, when we are not able to focus on God in our life, these apparent disasters happen. I feel all these problems and disasters that happen are God's way of attracting our attention to Him, telling, please focus on me. Because sadly we think of God only in times of sadness and sorrow and difficulties. Like how Kabir Das says, Dukh mein sumiran sab kare, sukh mein kare na koi. Everybody thinks of God in times of distress, in times of happiness nobody thinks of Him. And the second line is so beautiful and meaningful. I think that is what God tries to pull our attention to. Jo sukh mein sumiran kare, dukh ka hai ko hoi. In times of joy, if you are thinking of the Lord, why will ever sorrow come to you? That is the reason why God tries to take our attention to Him, to tell us that, dear one, if your attention is on Me, you will go beyond pain and suffering. You will never have to suffer this way at all. This is a permanent cure. Don't go for symptomatic cures by trying to earn relationships, money, power, all these. And that's why possibly He breaks the pots and spills our curds and butter so that we come and search for Him. Because as we see later on, I mean, please you continue with the story, because Swami writes how Krishna runs away and she is able to see those little footprints of that same curd and butter. That same thing that have been shattered is what actually leads her in her search for Krishna.
Right. Absolutely. In fact, if you look at it, even the idea of breaking of the pot, Swami would often say this, you know, when you say that Krishna would steal butter, Swami would say that is the, you know, the churned emotions of your heart is what is represented by the Navneeta or the butter, what Swami would say. That among all the feelings you churn yourself so much and you concentrate the most important aspects of your emotions and, you know, the purest ones, that is what forms this butter, and Krishna is interested in that. And that is what it is, you know, when some disaster happens in life and you're disturbed, that churning process stops, you know, properly. You're disturbed out of that focus and disturbed out of that peace. And you probably see the footprint of God in that mischief itself. You know, even when you're, that is what a devotee is able to do. When there is a disaster happening in life, I think most of us are able to see coincidences in pleasant occurrences. You know, when you're almost missing a bus and you catch it, and you're almost, you could have missed an opportunity, but, you know, somehow it happens. Mm. It's very easy to say, oh, you know, that's Swami's grace. But when something disastrous happens or when something unpleasant happens,
when pots break,
right,
and curds fall,
when you're able to see God's footprint in that, then you're actually a real devotee, and, you know, that's what Mother Yashoda does. She's pursuing the Lord in that. You know, she's not occupying herself in cleaning the mess, probably. And she's saying, first, let's catch this, you know, boy who has done this. And that's what Swami would say, that Krishna purposely runs all over this spilt butter and he runs away, giving Yashoda this opportunity to follow those footprints in coming in search of Krishna. And that's how she runs into the alleys of Gokul, trying to catch Krishna. She goes from house to house searching for him. And when she is following his footprints and then goes into one of these houses, she finds that Krishna has not only broken the pot in their own house, but he is now trying to pull down a pot which is tied up on a string from the ceiling and trying to break that pot and take butter from that. And that's when she gets all the more infuriated, because she says, no, this is no more mischief. This is bordering on the lines of theft. You're breaking into somebody's house and trying to take away things which are not yours. And she gets very angry. She catches Krishna and tries to reprimand him. And that's when Krishna runs away. And she starts chasing Krishna all along the road, and to everybody's delight. Because Swami says that actually that's what, the story of Bhagavatam says, that Yashoda is actually an elderly lady. She's not of the age of somebody who will be a mother of a 4-year-old, 5-year-old child, because she gets a child after a very, very long time. So she's an elderly lady, and she's, Swami says, on the, you know, heavier side of it. That's what Swami says. She's actually a little bulkily built. And so she struggles to run behind Krishna. And Krishna, being this little nimble-footed little child, he outruns the mother all the time.
And that's how Mother Yashoda is huffing and panting. And, you know, when Swami says, efforts are in your hand, the results are in the Lord's hand. That is exactly what it is. Because when Krishna actually gets caught, it is not because Yashoda managed to outrun him, but because Krishna decides that he is happy with the effort that the mother has put in, and he allows himself to be caught by Yashoda. And another thought that came when I was reading this was this, that when the devotee is running to catch the Lord, However much the devotee suffers, however much the devotee is exhausted or tired or whatever, it is a delight for everybody around. Now that is the reason we would like to listen to stories of Bhagwan's grace, even though the people, the devotees in the story might have suffered financially, suffered health-wise, suffered in many ways. It is not that we are sadists, but the focus is on the glory of the Lord, the blessing that the Lord gives, and that's why it is fun. And that's why I feel everything about the Lord's life is so metaphorical, about Swami's life, about Krishna's life, and here Mother Yashoda running behind Krishna is a sight of fun for everybody in Gokula. Possibly it would not have been if it was anybody else, but with the Lord it's always like that. The sight of a devotee trying to pursue and catch her Lord is definitely interesting, entertaining, and even inspiring for everyone around. Finally, Yashoda manages to catch Krishna and she tells that, I am not going to punish you here in front of everyone. Come, I'll take you back home. You know, that's what it is. Every parent feels that you should not punish your child in public or scold your child in public because it is embarrassing, possibly. Every new parent possibly forgets that there are so many parents around and everyone would have faced this. So it is not a problem if you are actually firm with your child in public. But it happens, and soon the child also learns that my parents are not so firm in public, so I can actually misbehave in public. So in a way it leads to a kind of vicious cycle. The advice given on multiple forums and by multiple experienced parents, parenting experts, what they say is no problem. If you have to be firm with your child in others' presence, don't feel embarrassed. Don't think what others will think, because any parents out there would have faced a similar situation and they understand, they empathize with you. So be firm, let not the child exploit that. Anyway, here Yashoda says, no, I'll take you home. So she takes Krishna home, and at home she decides that I will not allow you to do any more mischief, so I'm going to tie you up. And then Swami writes how she wanted to tie him up to a wooden mortar there, the same mortar with which she used to use for her cooking. But whatever rope she brought to tie Krishna, I think we described this also in one of our Bhagavata Vahini satsangs, it was always short. She had to struggle a lot, and it's only after a lot of great struggle that she finally managed to find a rope with which she could tie Krishna to this mortar.
Right, and again, it's the same thing where, you know, Krishna allows himself to be tied. And I was just talking to some of these students who come for the entrance exam, and a couple of them who just happened to come to meet us. Now I was telling them, work really hard. Not because by working hard you're going to get the seat, but by working hard, Swami will say that, okay, you've put some effort, and He will give His grace, because that's how it is with Swami. Anything that you receive from God, anything that you gain from God as a blessing, can never be earned. You know, though we use that word, earn His grace, you earn His grace.
You actually can only yearn, I think.
It can never be earned. You can never put enough effort that equals that blessing. It is always the Lord looking at you and saying that, okay, you have shown your earnestness, you have shown that you want this so badly, and I grace you. And that's typically what Krishna does on both occasions. He allows himself to be caught, and again, he allows himself to be tied too. And after that, you know, Mother Yashoda finally now goes back to clean up all the mess that he has done and go back with the work. But this, you know, as we said, the whole episode starts with Krishna being upset that he was ignored and he was not being the center of the attention. So now when the mother goes away, this little child now drags this huge mortar and starts walking outside the backyard.
Crawling
outside the backyard. And that's where there is this, right in the middle of the courtyard there is a twin Ashoka tree.
Arjuna trees.
They are like two trees, but I think they must be growing so close together they look like one tree. And there's just enough space for Krishna to walk through, crawl through, and that's what he does. He crawls through that gap, but the mortar is not big enough to go past that.
The gap is not big enough for the mortar,
right.
Yes.
The gap is not big enough for the mortar to pass through. And that's how the little child is stuck. He's tied to this mortar and the mortar is stuck behind the gap of that tree. And then he starts tugging at it. And that's when this huge two Arjuna trees falls down by this little 4-year-old, 3-year-old child pulling at it.
It comes, the trees come crashing down, and when that happens, everyone hears that thud because it's two mighty trees. Everyone gathers, including Mother Yashoda, and now she's very repentant. She's like, oh, what happened to my child? She immediately goes, picks him up, fondles him, and she sees, she's not able to believe what she sees. My little child, my little Kanha has brought down these two gigantic trees. It's unbelievable. But what they have missed in the meanwhile is that as the trees collapse, two beings emerge from that. And once again, they have been stuck in these two trees. And those two beings are Nalakubura and Manigriva. Manigriva. Manigriva and Nalakubura, who are the sons of Kubera, the Lord of Wealth. You know, there is, again, they have been cursed to become such trees. The story goes that so lost were they in wine, wealth and women. Wealth, naturally, their father is the Lord of Wealth. Wine and women. These are the three intoxicants that are considered as doorways to hell. You know, one small point I would like to make here. On one or two occasions when this was mentioned, people think that, is it that our scriptures look down upon women? You know, women are never told beware of men, but men are told beware of women. It is not like, you know, feminists will take up cudgels and say, what is this? It is not as if women are looked down upon as being doorways to hell or anything like that. Men and women are created with their strengths and weaknesses. And among the Arshad Vargas, it is said that lust or kama is a weakness that is prevalent more in men. And that is why men are told beware of women. It's not like that. Women have other weaknesses which therefore they are told to beware of. So because this is a weakness, that is why it is said to beware of. And it is that same weakness that makes a man more susceptible to indulge in all these three possibly. Wealth, women and wine. That alcohol also. And that is the reason it is said that it is not in any way demeaning of women. So these are the three W's. In fact, Swami says the three W's that you should look up to are work, worship and wisdom. Mm-hmm. That is actually the karma, bhakti and jnana. So these are the three W's to avoid. And having indulged in those three W's, in order to awaken them again, because they are already stuck. That is why sage Narada curses them to be Arjuna trees. It's almost like, you know, those who commit crime are sent to jail, and in jail they have to do some good deeds, you know. They do gardening and they do such things. It's like that. As Arjuna trees, they are providing shelter, they are providing sustenance to so much. And they are redeemed now by this act of Krishna. They mend their ways. Definitely, they have paid for their atrocities and sins or whatever they have done. And that is how Nalakubara and Manigriva are redeemed by Krishna. And the amazing thing is, though Mother Yashoda witnesses this, others also witness this, like many other such miracles of Krishna. Very soon they forget that, and Krishna once again becomes their darling little baby who needs to be caressed, fondled, protected, taken care of. And that is what Maya does actually. That is what has happened in our lives also. We have seen what Swami does, and we get lost in despair, we lose our faith in him, we ask Swami why this is happening, we think that Swami has left us. Having experienced him once, when we get such doubts, that is when we realize that this is the effect of Maya.
And that's when Parikshit asked this question, like, you know, what is this Maya made of, and who has created this Maya that it is so powerful that, you know, here is the Lord who has come in the human form, and the Lord comes to reveal himself. And this Maya is stopping that revelation and stopping a devotee from seeing the Lord. You know, it almost suggests that this Maya is more strong than the Lord who wants to show himself. Right? You know, here is the Lord who wants to reach out to the devotees, and there is something which is able to stop even the Lord who is supposed to be omnipotent. So that's why Parikshit asks, you know, what is this Maya made of, and how is it so much more powerful than the Lord himself? And that's when Sukamarshi laughs and he says, the Maya is not any different from the Lord. It is almost like the vesture that the Lord wears. The beautiful thing, the word that he uses is upadhi. He says upadhi is a means. Actually, that's what the meaning of that word in Sanskrit is. So when you say Maya is an upadhi, it means that Maya is a means by which you know God. And it can also be a means by which you get distracted from the Lord. It's almost like that which cannot be seen is given a form. You know, like the classic example which we often given in sciences, you know, the LPG gas that we have is natural gas is actually odorless. But we all know that LPG gas has a smell to it, you know, and I think they add a
mercaptan.
Yeah, mercaptan is the chemical that they add. The idea of adding that is when there is a gas leak, you kind of know that there is a gas leak.
But so an attribute is added for detection.
I think till the point we studied that in science, we always thought that that was an attribute of the gas, right? We thought that the gas smells, right? So similarly, I think the same thing, the God is actually formless. We do not have, you know, forms of perception to actually view God and adore God. But he, you know, he wears this vesture of Maya so that we can interact with him. But in the process, we get so attached to the idea, you know, just like probably air in a balloon, that we think that the balloon is the air, you know, if you could put it that way. But it actually, the balloon is giving you the opportunity to, you know, that's how we would measure the weight of air and we would measure the pressure of air and things like that. It gives you the opportunity to interact with, but somewhere we get distracted in the whole process.
You know, your analogy actually inspired me with a similar kind of, we have kept using drama and movies. So just imagine there is a person who has never seen movies and he comes to know that Amitabh Bachchan, is a great actor. He's in Bollywood, or say Tom Cruise, he's a fantastic actor. Mm-hmm. So he says, I would like to see Tom Cruise or Amitabh Bachchan. How do I see? We tell him a movie name and we say that, you know, the CIA agent there, that's Tom Cruise. Or this CBI agent there, that's Amitabh Bachchan. So we are making use of some attributes, some qualities to identify for that person who this actor Amitabh Bachchan is or Tom Cruise is. So when he sees the movie, he says, this is Amitabh Bachchan. So that is how it is. But if he thinks that Amitabh Bachchan is actually a CBI agent or Tom Cruise is actually a CIA agent, then he is mistaken, because that was just a pointer or an indicator. So I feel that is what Maya is about. Maya is a way, a pointer to show the actor. But if you think that it is only that the actor is all about, then I'm totally wrong. I'm totally off the point. Swami would give an analogy of how the finger is used to point out to the moon.
Right.
And we tell the child, look at my finger, look at my finger. See where the finger is. See where my finger ends. That is the moon. And Swami would say, once the child learns to see the moon by itself, you don't need the finger. You drop off the finger. But instead of that, if the child begins to think that the finger is the moon, then you have actually deluded the child. So Swami would say that is what even the name and form of the Lord is. See, every name and form of the Lord has some attributes and characteristics. Rama is tall with the bow. Krishna is dark with the chakra. Our beloved Swami, he is having that beautiful fluff of hair. He is short with the orange robe. See, all these are like the finger that point out to the divinity. The ultimate goal is for us to latch on to that same divinity, that is Krishna, that is Rama, that is Sai. Instead of that, if we get stuck with the finger, then that is when it is said we are in Maya, and that's why we get subjected to joys and sorrows. That is why when I get Swami in my dream in that beautiful form, he comes and pats me on my cheek, I feel joy. And that is why on 24th of April, just a few days back, when we sit in Mandir, when we recollect the days 7 years back, we get tears. That's because we are still holding on to the finger and not shifted our gaze to the moon.
Right, and this, the other analogy which he gives is very, very beautiful, and which again, as we said, these are all, we have no clue whether Sukha Maharshi actually told all these things. I'm sure, you know, obviously, because the conversation went on for 7 days and there must have been so much more that he spoke. But among the discussions which happened between Sukha Maharshi and Parikshit, I think Swami chose to pass on some of these things, maybe because these are the things which are relevant to us.
Mm.
And one of the analogies which he says is, you know, he says, and Swami has quoted this elsewhere too, where Maya is like the mirage, where it appears like there is water and you move towards it and then you find that there is no water.
Mm.
And here Sukha Maharshi is saying that, you know, we all have experienced this. We've seen the mirage. The moment you have the knowledge of a mirage, you know, you have the scientific knowledge that something like this is created because of, you know, the sun's rays and the vapors arising from any heated surface or whatever it is. You have the scientific understanding of how a mirage is created. It does not take away the mirage from your vision. The mirage is still there, but you know what it is and you stop running after it. And he says the same thing happens with Maya too. The moment you recognize it, it does not mean that the whole scene, you know, blanks out and there's only illumination everywhere. The Maya still exists. The images still exist. You still have these different bodies and you still have these different, the Dvaita, the vision of Dvaita is still there. But you stop running after it. You stop basing your actions and choices based on that idea that this is real, right? And
he says, like that statement, nothing changes, yet everything changes.
Right, exactly. And he says that is what knowledge is. The moment you have knowledge that this is Maya, you don't even have to have anything more than that, the way you interact with it completely changes. And in fact, there's a very beautiful statement that Swami makes in Jnanavahini. Swami says that Maya is actually the mother of wisdom. He says, because only where there is Maya, wisdom can be born. If there is no ignorance at all, there is no question of wisdom being born. So Swami says that Maya is the mother, wisdom is the child who performs matricide, Swami says. The moment the child is born, it kills the mother which has given birth to it. And he says that is what wisdom is. And that's what he says here. The moment you know that this is the difference and the rest of it is the mind, this is my reality, this is my real sense. And at that point, the veil drops away and you see everything. Everything remains the same. As you said, nothing changes, but everything else changes because you've seen things as they are meant to be seen.
There are other examples or other comparisons also that Swami makes. Swami says that Maya is like the ashes that are over the cinder, cinders, burning cinders, the embers. So it looks like it is cool, but actually it is very hot if you remove the ashes. It's like the clouds that cover the sun. It's like the cataract in the eyes. It's like the moss over the Manasarovar, over the lake. You know, it looks like a solid ground because of the moss, but actually it has to be cleared. So Maya is like that. It hides the reality and makes it appear like something else. Then, you know, Shuka Maharshi goes on to say that everybody realizes that they are not the body, possibly. But that's why the body comes to an end. But mind is something that doesn't come to an end. And that's why, you know, Swami in many of his discourses keeps saying that all your desires, everything, what is your last thought before death is what determines your next birth. Because at the moment of death, as we have seen in the case of Parikshit, the priorities get reorganized and your top priority comes first. And therefore, at the time of death, what you're thinking about is definitely your top priority. And that is what is going to determine your next birth, because it is the mind that has to work out all the karma and everything and get, become freed. And therefore, though you lose your body at the end of each birth, you continue to remain in Maya because the mind remains. It is only when the mind is also sublimated, when the mind is also dissolved, that you are truly liberated. And Swami beautifully writes, a mind that is completely lost in the Lord no longer has its own existence. It is the Lord itself. And that is what happened to Parikshit. And that is why his Dehabhimana was totally gone. That is the reason he could actually renounce and give up everything without the slightest trace of hesitation or sorrow or regret. That is why he was able to look even at the person who cursed him with so much of love and respect and regard. Otherwise, just imagine, forget cursing us with death. Somebody abuses us itself, we look at them with so much of irritation and hatred. But Parikshit has been freed from that Dehabhimana, he has been freed from that Maya. And that is why he is now ready to depart. And what he intended to achieve through these 7 days of Shravanam from the Kirtana of Shuka Maharshi has actually borne fruit. Because now Parikshit has reached that level, that state, where he is ready to leave. And it doesn't matter to him when that will happen, where it will happen, how it will happen, nothing concerns him at all. Because it is just now, the body is just a nimittam which is just holding. He has no more attachments, he is even freed from his mind. And that is the kind of preparedness and readiness that Parikshit is made to achieve through these 7 days. And that is how Swami concludes one of the few last few chapters of this Bhagavata Vahini, saying that Parikshit is now all set and ready.
Right. I mean, the way Swami describes it is so beautiful. He says, you know, when does death occur to a body? Swami says, when the pranavayus leave the body, the death occurs. And Swami is, I think elsewhere, he has said that that is based on the karmas, the prarabdha of the body when it is assumed. So Swami says the prana comes, life comes in the body, prana leaves and the body falls dead. But Swami says, how does the mind live on? Very beautifully he says, the mind lives on because of this thought that I am the body. He says, because of this body consciousness, that does not leave the mind. The prana leaves the body, but that body consciousness does not leave the mind. So the mind seeks another body and it goes into that. So he is saying that, Sukamashi is telling Parikshit, but the moment you realize that this body is only a temple, I am not this body, this body is only a temple and the Lord is within. That's when he says, when you concentrate your mind on the Lord, even the body consciousness leaves the mind as the prana leaves the body. And he says, then the mind does not seek another body to go into.
Beautiful.
And the moment he says this, Parikshit says, I am ready. Because, I mean, I don't think any of us will be in a position to say that. That would be very ostentatious to say that. But Parikshit realizes that he is really in that state. That he does not have any attachment to the body. He has come to that state where he is ready to discard it. And his mind is in a state where it is constantly thinking of the Dehi and not the Deha. So he knows that now if I drop my body, the mind will not seek another body to enter into. It is ready to, you know, go beyond.
You know, we have discussed this in different satsangs at different point in times. Just feel like sharing it again now, that when we say our spiritual growth and where we are, we had done a satsang on how do we measure our spiritual progress. This thing came up that it is not as if we are in different levels. The same person can possibly be in different levels at different points in time. When we are listening to Swami's discourses, when we are enjoying his darshan, we are at one level. When we are lost in our workplace, when we are so filled with all this, you know, this competitive rat race that the world is, we are at a different spiritual level. So, we have concluded on many occasions that sadhana is about reaching that state and remaining in that state always. Because honestly, Prem, when you said, when we were reading and we were listening to this, that Parikshit is ready, when you said it would be ostentatious for us to say that, for a moment from inside, I just felt, no, actually right now listening to this, I'm feeling such a thrill that I'm ready. You know, possibly if I die this moment, I will also be liberated. But the fact is, we don't know when we are going to die. And therefore, it becomes so important that we do sadhana, that this thought that I am the Dehi and not the Deha remains foremost in our thoughts always, because we never know when death comes. But this much we can be assured, that if this is our thought always, just like Parikshit said, whenever it happens, wherever it happens, however it happens, it will not matter, because we are firmly fixed in this thought. And that is why we need a lifetime of practice, because we can't choose our death. It's only those blessed souls like Bhishma or Parikshit. Bhishma could choose when to die. Parikshit was given a time. We don't know when it is. That's why though right now possibly engrossed in this satsang, we are totally lost in Swami, totally lost in Krishna, we say that we are ready actually. And if we die now, we are actually liberated. But sadly, that's not in our control. And if I go back now and I'm riding my bike, some dog comes and I start cursing the dog and I die there, that's it. You know, that's my last thought. Not G-O-D, but D-O-G. So that is why it becomes so important that we live in thoughts of Swami, we live in thoughts of our Lord. Dear listeners, as Prem and me, both of us speak here, we are just opening up our hearts and sharing. In no way does it suggest that we are more elevated, we are down, nothing. It's nothing like that. But it just makes us realize more and more how important it is that every moment of our life, as much as possible, we keep Swami as our foremost thought, because then everything automatically gets set right. On that note, dear listeners, we will bring this satsang to a close. You can write into us with your thoughts, your feedback, whatever you wish, as always, to listener@radiosai.org. We offer this humbly at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. And as per schedule, the next week we will take up a general theme. And a fortnight after today, we will be coming back to possibly the last fortnight of the Bhagavata Vahini. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
नंद किशोरा नवनीत छोरा नंद किशोरा नवनीत छोरा वृंदावन संचारा वृंदावन संचारा हे शेष शयना हे गरुड गमना हे शेष शयना हे गरुड गमना अरविंद नयन गोपाल ना अरविंद नयन गोपाल ना नंद किशोरा नवनीत छोरा वृंदावन संचारा हे शेष शयना हे गरुड गमना अरविंद नयना गोपालना अरविंद नयना गोपालना नंद किशोरा नवनीत छोरा
Tune into Sai. Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
A single story of His infinite glory, captured through divine discourses, music, bhajans, and through Vedas, talk shows, interviews, panel discussion, and study circles. All brought to you live from the epicenter of our times, Prashanthi Nilayam, India. Radio Sai Thursday Live.